low of 66. Thursday, cloudy, turning cooler. Tomorrow's high, 76. For the rest of the week, 79 on Friday, into the 80s for both Saturday and Sunday. Right now, wind from the southwest at 8. Sunshine, blue skies, 70 degrees, Kenosha and Racine, 67 for Burlington, Elkhorn, Lake Geneva, and Milwaukee. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. Support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information online at carthage.edu/grad. Support also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. Don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, Kenosha. Online at andreasgifts.com.
We're going to be talking about divorce on today's morning show. But I promise you that this will not be as unpleasant a conversation as you might assume. And the book we're going to be talking about is not as unpleasant a book as I frankly assumed it to be as I first looked at its title and explored what it was about. In fact, I think the conversation we have is going to be also very helpful, even for those of you who are either not married at all or happily married with no likelihood of becoming divorced at any time in your life. But this book gave me all kinds of things to think about in terms of the way I relate not only to my own wife, but to other people, the way I see the world, and the way I weather transitions of one kind or another. There's a whole lot to be learned from this wonderful new book called Splittopia, Dispatches from Today's Good Divorce and How to Part Well. As you might guess from the title, Wendy Paris, the author, has herself experienced divorce. But she has experienced divorce in just about as positive a way as you can, although it's important to say that her divorce was not without some difficulty, without some pain. And it's because of that, though, that she'd learned a lot about herself and a lot about the experience of divorce. And, of course, there isn't just one divorce in the same way that not all marriages are the same. So she writes with tremendous discernment about how complex this experience can be, how one size does not fit all, but also how divorce can be an incredibly positive, transformative experience. She brings a wealth of experience as a writer to this task. Her work has appeared in Psychology Today, New York Times, among many other places. And she has written two previous books, one about dating, one about marriage. This latest, though, called Splittopia, which, by the way, is not a book about marriage and not about how to avoid divorce, but a book not about the if, but the how. She writes, there are books to help you decide if you should stay married or get divorced. This is not one of them. It does not attempt to figure out the if, but rather the how. And it's beautifully written. Wendy Paris, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate that introduction.
And I love the introduction to your book, and I especially like the way it ended when you write that there have been uncountable books and operas and musicals and songs and sonnets written about love and about marriage, for that matter. But and certainly plenty of stories about tremendously painful, wrenching divorces. You say the good divorce is largely an unwritten tale. I suppose, in a sense, it just has been the kind of story that, for whatever reason, has not been especially inspiring to writers and composers and so on. Any thoughts on why that is, why that has been the case?
And the divorce has changed dramatically in recent years, but in the past, before no-fault, the first no-fault law went into effect in 1970. Before that, you could only get divorced if your spouse had committed a crime or some, you know, morally reprehensible behavior. Like, you could not get divorced in the United States unless your spouse had hit you or cheated or committed a felony or, you know, the exact details vary. So it wasn't a thing where we had any sense that we could create a story, that there could be any romance in our life after. It was, you know, it was like going to jail in some ways. And the fact that divorce is still housed in the court is a remnant from those days. I'm part of this whole out-of-court divorce movement. But so I think in terms of narrative, you know, we have tons of narratives about lost love and aching and longing and found love. But the idea of what kind of relationship am I going to have with the person I was married to now that I'm not married? And what is my life going to look like as a single person, or hopefully not a single person forever? That's not been something that we could really create until recently.
So there's a reason then why we have sort of scant accounts of good divorces, because in a sense, good divorces are, at least by and large, a fairly recent phenomenon, a fairly recent possibility.
Yeah, it's relatively new. There have always been, you know, decent divorces. You hear about them, or, you know, couples will move apart and even not get divorced. But there's also been this overhang of morality. And people who are come from religious traditions like Catholics or evangelical Christians still have a lot of struggle, you know, if they get divorced, even if it's the spouse who left. You know, there's this feeling that I've failed in the eyes of God, and so it's very difficult to, it's much more difficult for those people to say, okay, what do we know now about loss? What do we know now about post-traumatic growth? Or what do we know about child development, and how can I do the best on the other side? People definitely do, but it's more of a struggle. So I think in terms of, you know, a good story, there's also that kind of guilt and shame that is still, like, there's this overhang of it on divorce.
Hmm. You write so perceptively about your own experience with divorce, and I have a couple of questions very specifically about that, although I want to hasten to add that you took the time to talk to all kinds of other people about their divorces. So this is not just a memoir about what you experienced personally, but it also takes into account the experience of all kinds of people. We really get a sense of the breadth of experience that divorce can offer up. So I really appreciate that.
People really want to talk about it. I mean, sorry, but I talk about this in the book, right? People, you know, I talk to strangers on airplanes and people in the park. Like, when we go through a divorce, we're often reluctant to talk about it. We feel like it's a black mark on our record, or, you know, we're still processing. But if you're writing a book, or if you're just out there and open up, people really will share their stories. So I have this kind of great sort of moments of intimacy with strangers. I talked to probably 200 people, you know, in addition to the more methodical research. But it's kind of one of the things that's sort of beautiful about this kind of loss is that you can make these connections with people that you wouldn't have otherwise.
Hmm. At what point did you start to seriously think about writing about divorce and, of course, including such a frank account of your own personal experience with divorce? I mean, how long after the fact did you decide that you were going to do this? Or even in the midst of it, did you already have a sense that at some point, once the dust settled a bit, you were going to write about this?
You know, it's funny, I have two answers. I write a lot of personal essays, and I had started, during my marriage, I had started, you know, some personal essays about divorce, and then there was nothing to do with them because I was married, you know, and I couldn't, my mother and stepfather split up, and I felt this vague sense of I wish I could do that, but I wasn't doing it. So I have like some beginnings of essays, but there was nothing, you know, you can't publish a book about thinking, an essay about thinking about divorce when you're married. Like, you know, I felt there was no way to do that. So that's one answer. And then as we were deciding to split up, I wasn't working, and, you know, I've worked as a journalist, and there's fewer and fewer jobs as a journalist, and I applied, and I thought it could be remote. I mean, I write about this in the book, surviving, but divorce is something that had been, how can I do this anyway? And, you know, that feeling is something that, you know, I wanted to infuse the book with, that feeling of, well, I'm realizing here's something I want to do. In my case, I want to write about divorce, but I don't want it to be like I can only write about divorce in this one context, you know, if I get this job and they give me a paycheck. I wanted a, like, only ability to write about divorce, and a friend and I, you know, talked about it over a series of a few weeks, and he really encouraged me to write a book and said, I believe you can do it, and I think it's important, and we, you know, together kind of came up with this book idea, and I sold an essay to the New York Times around the same time. So I was working on, I was sort of walking around saying, I'm doing a good divorce, not even a good divorce, I'm doing a divorce project. You know, I don't exactly know what the theme is yet or how it's gonna manifest itself, but this is something I want to write about.
I appreciate how you characterize your marriage and your divorce in such clear terms. You are careful to be respectful of your ex-husband, and you are careful to share with us the things that were positive about him, as well as the things that are negative. I mean, it just seems like such a measured portrait of who he was, of who you were and are, and a very honest portrait of what your marriage was, and in a sense, what your marriage was not. I think it's easy to read something like that and kind of assume that arriving at that was a fairly simple process. And I suspect, in fact, it was not all that simple a matter of being that balanced and being that respectful and yet that frank and honest in writing about such intensely personal matters. Just talk for a moment about the care with which you tried to do that, and maybe a bit about what it felt like knowing that your husband would know that this book was being written, and presumably at some point he would read it.
Yeah, no, that's a really interesting question. My background or my passion has been the personal essay, and you know, I went back to graduate school, you know, halfway through my career and studied the personal essay, and the classic personal essay essay is a French word for to try, right? And so the essay is you're trying to figure out what you think on the page, and you know, maybe it's this, maybe it's that, and you go back and forth, and it is it's honest. Like, the thing you do in a personal essay is you be as honest as you can about yourself. It's not like a Facebook post, you know. An essay is not let me look my most impressive, you know, let me shine up, you know, polish all the rough edges. So I like that form, and I feel comfortable with that, and I have long felt, you know, part of my charge as a writer is, you know, that I'm willing to say the things other people are thinking, but maybe are embarrassed to say. You know, I'm not embarrassed to say that. I'm not embarrassed to expose, you know, my own foibles, and so since I can do that, I feel like a little bit charged to do that. And then other people can say, okay, that's right. That's how I felt too, and feel a little better, you know, because they're seeing that there is a universality to their experience and they're not alone. So in terms of myself, you know, the pride of doing a good essay is being as honest as you can. And so that, you know, for sure is something I was trying to do when I was writing as we were going through this divorce. You know, I started the book about 6 months after my husband moved out, you know, and I was coming home basically every day and doing sort of free writing or almost like journal writing, like what happened today? How do I feel about it? So I have, you know, 300 pages of my personal story, and it was a huge amount of work to, you know, pull out of that. Okay, I have maybe 3 or 4 pages that I can give you a personal story before you don't want to hear anything else about me and you want to know, you know, what's the point or how does this relate to you? So there's a lot of cutting of the personal. And, you know, my first draft of this was much longer and, you know, cutting out the personal. And so, you know, I feel pretty good about that. There's a, you know, one section in my friend's chapter where I think I cut too much. You know, there's a whole lot more that's not there. So that's a little frustrating as a writer, but you're trying to be respectful, you know, of the reader and not make this a, you know, like a diary. And also you have a page count you're limited to. So, you know, in terms of me, that was definitely work. In terms of my ex-husband, you know, he had to read it before I published it. And, you know, I did this one little essay I mentioned for the New York Times and had him read it before I went out with it, and there was a line in it that he felt was very offensive, but I thought was just true. Like, it was a line like he, you know, didn't have the idea of being a team player in a marriage. And he, and also his mother, felt like that wasn't a true reflection and it wasn't fair. So, you know, I took that line out. And, you know, for him, being a team player has a different meaning. So there's enough to say, you know, there's enough to say without having to say things that feel specifically critical to the other person. And then, you know, in this, I had a, in my chapter six, I described this medical crisis. And, you know, the chapter is called Hurricane. And when I wrote the proposal, I didn't know there was going to be a chapter on medical crisis. I didn't know that that was going to happen to me. There's also a chapter on boundaries, which was not in my original proposal. So because I was taking notes as I was going through it, I wound up saying like, oh, wow, this happened to me, this medical crisis. Is this common? And then I, you know, started asking around and found out that almost everybody has some kind of medical crisis, like they can't sleep or they lose weight. It doesn't have to be as serious as mine where I wound up in the hospital, but, you know, sometimes it is. So that enabled me to really, you know, flesh out the book in a way that hopefully is more relevant to a lot of people. But he, you know, his behavior in that chapter was not so great in certain ways. And, you know, but I'm telling the story. So I have to be careful if as a writer, I say, well, he did this and he did that and he was so insensitive and he had to get his girlfriend a cup of coffee before taking me to the hospital. You know, you as the reader are going to wind up siding with him because he's not having an opportunity to tell his side of the story. So this is just like a craft answer to your question. But, you know, not that I want to be disingenuous about things I think he did wrong, but, I had to be very measured and fair to him because I wasn't giving him the chance to weigh in and give his opinion about himself.
Well, I think better to ask him, I suppose, but in my opinion, you did a really good job of doing that, and I'm sure that was quite a challenge. You talk about how you were almost systematic in researching this topic in terms of reaching out to both family and friends you knew had experienced divorce. You visited support groups and chat rooms, talked to lawyers, read other books, and so on. So part of this springs from very systematic, measured research. But then you go on to say that the most exciting part of the research involved the chance encounters, often with strangers sharing intimate details about their divorces and lessons that they had learned, seemingly random interactions. I wonder if you could just say a word about if you treated that information any differently than some of the other information that is shared in your book that, for instance, springs from the research of a psychologist or whatever. I mean, what's it like to sort of be given rather intimate information from somebody who you don't actually know? I mean, you don't know their history, their context. You don't know how honest they are, if they're giving just their side of the story. In a sense, what is the ultimate value of those kind of encounters and whatever stories were shared with you in those encounters?
That's a good question. I credit these things equally, you know, because a research study also could have flaws in its methodology, but it's interesting. You know, a research study is interesting. So with a study, I try to say, you know, here's a really interesting study. I didn't include ones that seemed, like, to me, not well done. And there are absolutely studies that are not well done or that are too small of a sample set. So a study, which seems like the ultimate official source of information, it's just really a study. So I try to say, you know, here's an interesting study, here's what they concluded, here's what I make of it. And I think that same, I'm going to make, you know, my assessment is going to be the final, you know, I'm going to read the stuff and process it, and then I'm going to give you my assessment of it rather than just, you know, throwing 20 studies at you. You know, I'm going to distill them and think about it and tell you what I think. And I have the same feeling with strangers. I think, in a way, I think people will be very honest, and often, especially on an airplane, I have this whole airplane poll in here where I do this unofficial survey of the state of the American family today based on strangers sitting next to me in airplanes. And, you know, you're trapped with a stranger for 4 hours, and you start talking, and you say, oh, I'm working on a book about divorce. And, no, you know, 3 out of 4 strangers will say, oh, my gosh, let me tell you about mine. So even, you know, and to me, there's a real emotional truth that people will share. And I'm not, you know, I'm not a judge. They're not going to pressure to make sure that that they come off looking well. And when they do, I've had friends, on more than one occasion telling me about how awful the ex is. And, you know, it's this entire case they're building against the ex. And very often when that happens, I am hearing underneath their words their own fault in it. Does that make sense?
Right.
So like, when, and it's the more one-sided a story, you know, he did this, he doesn't have to work, and I have to work, and he doesn't have to work, you know, and they're, you know, going on and on about how he doesn't have to work, he has family money, and I'm thinking, well, that fact isn't really relevant to how well you're doing or how your children are doing, but it's obviously something, you know, you're obsessing about. So I guess also as a journalist, I, you know, have spent a lot of years asking questions, you know, listening closely, and this is another thing that I, you know, pride myself on, is being able to really have an honest conversation or a good conversation and get to the interesting point. So it was exciting to me to be working on this project, which was so important to me, and, you know, people really want to talk about it. It's, you know, it's so challenging for people to deal with. So I felt fortunate to have those conversations, and then I feel like any story I get, there's a truth to their experience. There's a truth to their feeling. And if they're telling me logistically what they did, there's often a lot of information I felt I could get from people's stories. And then sometimes I would call the ex-husband, the ex-wife, because there's a sense of, okay, is this one-sided? Am I getting both sides? In some cases, I talk to the grown children or I talk to the parents. So, you know, I did try to be, you know, as rounded or as objective as possible. But often that didn't seem important. Like if a guy said to me, my parents got divorced when I was a kid and they didn't speak to each other, so I fell in with the kind of gang in our neighborhood and would lie to both of them and stay out all night, but they never could check up on me because they weren't speaking to each other. So when I got divorced, I vowed not to do that, and I kept a good relationship with my ex-wife, and I lived down the street, and I'm on top of my kids, and they're not going to have that experience. That story, I don't need to verify if he really, you know, ran amok or his parents didn't talk to each other. Like, that's his experience, and that's very useful for a reader.
I'm speaking with Wendy Paris, author of Splittopia, Dispatches from Today's Good Divorce and How to Part Well. It is an exploration of not only her own experience with divorce, but also the experience of all kinds of people that she reached out to and spoke with about this really complex topic. And it is an exploration of the ways in which divorce can be a positive experience, maybe much more positive than one might assume. And of course, Wendy Paris, one of the things you're talking about in this book is the hope that we can discard assumptions that were made for literally generations about divorce being always a bad thing, always kind of a nasty thing. And you point out quite rightly that assuming divorce must be dreadful often ensures that outcome. I mean, if that is indeed your expectation, chances are your divorce will live up to those very expectations. So you are about trying to transform our idea, loosen our ideas, our vision of what a divorce is. Actually, you got really good advice early on when you began to first have marital trouble from a therapist in New York City, who gave you this advice: marriage and divorce are not any one thing. And in a sense, I suppose that could be sort of the thesis sentence for your book, that we are so much better off when we sort of rid ourselves of this notion that marriage is one single thing and divorce is also one single thing.
Right. That's interesting. And I met that therapist because I had met a woman, in a mommy baby class in Manhattan who was going to France with her ex-husband. And, you know, at the time I was really so unhappy in my marriage, although my husband isn't a horrible person. You know, I like him, but boy, what we wanted from marriage was so different from each other. You know, what felt like intimacy to him and what he thought the role of marriage was, it was so different from what I was looking for. And, you know, we sort of knew it, but we didn't fully realize it until we got married, and it was, you know, very difficult for me. So I met this woman who was going to France with her ex-husband, and I was like, wait a minute, you can get divorced and still travel with your ex. Like, where do I sign up? How can I do that? And so that sort of started this this question of, oh, is there some new style of divorce happening? You know, is there a way to just be not married to this person but still have a relationship with this person who you liked enough to marry, you know, you loved enough to marry? So that kind of, I went off, you know, investigating, you know, is that true? And who's able to do that and why? And this therapist who you mentioned, I met, that woman recommended this therapist. So that sort of, you know, that's an example of how kind of, you know, intimate and person by person a lot of my research was. And I was really interested in what's changed legally, what's changed culturally, what's changed economically that's allowed for that kind of thing, you know, that kind of more cooperative divorce. And I also, as I went back later, you know, and reconnected with that woman and interviewed her a few times, and in fact, she had had a horrible experience. Her husband had had an affair. He's from France. He had gone to France to be with the new woman. They have a child, but she wanted another child, and, you know, but her husband left, and she had gone to therapy for a long time and talked about advice she got to when she was ruminating negatively and wanted to walk in front of a truck. A therapist gave her advice to wear a rubber band on her wrist and snap it whenever she started to get into this negative rumination, to remind herself to stop and focus on something more positive. And her therapist said, you know, people can get stuck in anger for 20 years. I have seen people destroy their lives by not being able to get over this. So this was, you know, such an interesting story and a good story for me in this book, because here I'm thinking, oh, you know, she has a decent divorce. It must have just been, you know, it must have been a mutual decision. It must have been easy, but it was incredibly hard. And she still said, she's one of the people who said, I don't want to have the divorce my parents had. I don't want to put my daughter in the middle, and I don't want to destroy my life because of what he's done. I want to be able to, you know, take back control of my life and have our daughter feel comfortable with both her parents. So I loved, you know, meeting her and then being able to see that it isn't just the mutual decisions, you know, the divorces that start out amicably that can be transformed into something positive.
I appreciated the way in which you characterized one facet of your marriage. And, of course, our conversation needs to be about divorce and not to replay the story of your marriage itself and the drama and the reasons for its ultimate dissolution. But I really think this was an interesting way that you chose to describe the way in which your marriage was built. And I just think it would be helpful for our listeners to kind of think about this a little bit. We should mention that you were 38 and your husband was 39 when you got married. Yes. So it's not something you certainly did in haste. But you said, I felt at times that we were building our marriage from the outside in, erecting the scaffolding of a life and hoping the foundation would pour itself in. That is a really interesting picture, and I suspect that we have people listening to this interview that maybe can relate to that, that can identify with that. Can you just say a quick word about maybe the most important ways in which this was true about your marriage, that you were building it from the outside in instead of from within?
You know, I had this sense of not quite having enough emotional intimacy, you know, not quite feeling connected, not quite feeling secure in my home. And, you know, we talk about it, and he'd sort of say, well, you want this merge relationship, and that's not as good of a relationship as when people are more independent and, you know, just come together at the end of the day or something. So he, you know, we sort of knew we had this difference, and I thought, well, maybe he's right, you know, maybe I can go with it. But so, you know, it was very uncomfortable for me. And I also talk about it being like a molten chocolate lava cake, you know, that's like a delicious dessert, but when you have that wobbly center, it gives you, you know, it can give you an ulcer in a marriage. And I think, you know, it isn't exactly like we thought, oh, we'll get the pretty house and the big car and, you know, it'll look good to others and that will be a marriage. It isn't exactly like that, but I think people do that. But there was an element of that where we liked the same people. We had a good social life. We'd throw parties and it would be really fun. We'd Every time we'd have a party, I'd feel more kind of centered because I'd had people around and many, many conversations. And, you know, he likes to have parties too. And so I'd feel like, okay, here I am. I'm in my home. You know, I'm in my life. But then when, you know, we clean up from the party and, you know, the party was over, and then his style of independence and just kind of like he would wake up in the morning and think, well, what do I want to do today? And I would wake up in the morning and think, what do we want to do today? And that gap, you know, continually made me feel anxious at home. So I think that there can be a tendency to really look at the life you're building and love that life. And many people get married because they want to get married. They want to have a family. You know, they want to have children. And in the past, you know, when we didn't expect to have a romantic connection and when we didn't expect our spouse to help support our dreams, I think that would work. But today we have so many expectations on our marriage. And because, I mean, I write about this in the beginning, because marriage is optional, you know, it's not essential to get married, to do the things we want to do in life. It's not essential for survival. And the way it really was for thousands of years, because it's a choice, we can choose out of it if it's not fulfilling. So if you have a marriage that's built from the outside in, or is about the functionality of it, if you're somebody who's got a big emotional life like me, you may not be able to sustain it.
Right. I'm so glad that your book takes such a long view, particularly in helping us understand why there seems to be almost this innate, visceral distaste for or hostility towards divorce. You write at one point, this hostility toward divorce makes sense if you consider the vulnerability of families and of women in particular for most of human history. For thousands of years before the birth of Christ and afterward, well into the Middle Ages, life was about survival more than satisfaction. Marriage was part of the extended family effort to stay alive. And, of course, you posed to yourself the question of what happened in the 1970s when divorce rates began to really skyrocket. And you ultimately point to our shift towards wanting emotional satisfaction as part of married life. And it's no surprise that when our expectations shift dramatically, there are going to be then wrenching changes in many, many marriages, and it's no surprise that there were so many divorces then and ever since.
Right. I take a demographic view, and I talk a little bit about some demographers who they talk about the first and second transition. It's a transition in how we live our lives and then what we expect from marriage as part of it. And I think it's really important. And It's because it was so essential, as you just read, for thousands of years. If somebody left a marriage, it could be a life or death situation. You needed that partner. But now, you know, I'm a single woman. I can, the laws allow me to work. The laws allow me to earn. The laws allow me to have my own credit card or buy my own house. This was not the case in the United States in the 20th century. I, as a woman, couldn't even get my own credit card, or I couldn't own my own business. So I needed a man. And there's this history, something called couverture, where when you got married, the woman's identity was subsumed by the man. The woman became part of the man. So if the man left, the woman has no identity and no legal rights. And, you know, for men, men were off working or, you know, fighting the lions or whatever they were doing and creating a home, raising the children, the kinds of things that women did, you know, they needed a partner. Today, men can cook, men can clean, men take responsibility for children in the way they didn't before. This is a sort of a shallow way of saying it, but we can even have children on our own now, right? We don't even need, essentially, a married partner for that. So I'm saying, you know, let's just be a little more clear-headed and, yeah, take a long view about the role of marriage. And I do say, I have a little section about, you know, is this a divorce or is this a marriage sabbatical? Because sometimes really taking a break and getting some distance can let people remember why they married in the first place and, you know, try again. And I quote a scholar who was very anti-divorce and had this idea that we have these, you know,
they want to marry, but as our expectations for love, intimacy, as you first...
Yes, I worked on them over the course of, I was going to, you know, talk about this to people in other ways. How would I encapsulate the ideas of the book? So that was a few a few reasons why I wanted to do these principles.
Right. I'm going to read them. The seven principles of parting that you created for this book are, number one, commit to self-compassion, which I think is something you have borrowed from some Buddhist principles. Number two, take ownership of the future and the past. Number three, don't confuse filing with closure. That is filing for divorce, that just the filing of the paperwork does not achieve closure. Number four, build a toolkit for the transition. Number five, combat anger with empathy. Number six, resist the urge to compare. Number seven, create positive moments. There's a whole lot here, and it's hard to know even where to begin. But one of the things I want to leap to number two, because I think number one, although I'm glad you talk about it, is fairly self-evident, that one should be compassionate with oneself as you're going through something as difficult as this, and also understand that you're not the only person in the universe experiencing something like this. But right after that, you say take ownership of the future. And as you write about this, you say, what? Didn't you just say not to blame myself? And yet you do say here, we need to take ownership of what has happened and what is coming next. Why do you think this is an important thing for people to keep in mind?
So right. So I'm saying be compassionate with yourself, be as kind to yourself as you would to a friend, but you also need to see your role. And this is so important. I just watched a friend of mine really destroy her life because she, 8 years later, he did this to me, he left, you know, he's destroyed my life. And when you do that, if you can't get past that, you're a victim, and it's possible to be victimized and not to be a victim. So take ownership means you want to see your role in what happens to you. You want to see that you have an impact on your life, because agency correlates with resilience after loss. So agency is, my actions matter. What I do matters. I have some power over my life. So an example that I give that I think is really important is, say your spouse had an affair. And you stayed in it for a year trying to make it work. And you stayed in it, and finally he left. And it's, you know, often it's the woman who had the affair. It's, you know, it's not just the man, but say the man leaves. You could say, why did I stick around? You know, I always get stepped on. He left me. He abandoned me. You know, I'm a sucker. I'm a doormat. And if you tell yourself that story, he took all the action, you took none of the action, and it's, you're sort of powerless to go forward. But if you find a way to see your role in that, you know, one part might be, in what ways did you contribute to the downfall of the marriage? Were you so preoccupied with work that you weren't maybe as present for him? Or did you maybe choose somebody you weren't in love with enough? I mean, those things sound harsh, but the people who do well are the ones who say, okay, I have a guy in here whose wife cheated, and he said, okay, it was definitely a joint fail, of which she did the most egregious failing. But he can see that he, you know, this guy was too preoccupied with work, and, you know, there are various reasons that she was unhappy enough to stray. So that's part of it. But another part, let's say this the woman who stayed in it for a year and then is beating herself up. Why didn't I leave right away? You know, I always, you know, I just let people take advantage of me. And she can flip that and say, you know, I stuck with that for a year, despite how painful it was. I kept in there. I am somebody who sticks with my commitments. I give everything I have to the agreements, to the people I love. I wanted to be there for my children. I spent a year fighting for this marriage. I am a fighter. I am a strong person. That is true, right? That is as true as I stuck in it too long. But if she can say that to herself, wow, I really gave it everything I can. Then when she's looking forward, she can say to herself, you know, here's something I know about myself. I really stick with things. I love the people I love. I am willing to put up with a lot of pain in order to make something work, in order to salvage something. So, you know, as I'm going forward, let me make sure I'm choosing something I want to be in. Here's a strength. If I commit to going back to school, I know I'm going to stick with it because I look at how I stuck with my marriage. You know, it's a narrative shift, but it's a taking ownership and seeing your own power in the situation.
You're right. By seeing your contributions to the downfall of your marriage, you cast yourself as someone with agency. So I suppose in a way then, divorce is not just something that sort of happened to me, that just fell on top of me, but something that I had at least, you know, some small role in, that that's better than a sense of utter powerlessness. I want to also make sure we talk about the fifth of these seven principles, in which you talk about anger, and of course the fact that often we harbor anger. And this is a point that I appreciate, even beyond the realms of how to have a healthy marriage and how to have a healthy divorce, even beyond those parameters. This is really intriguing stuff that you are writing here. This is how you describe an experience in your own life where you were really kind of frustrated with something that your husband had done. I think he had really sort of almost forced the two of you to build a some kind of country cabin that turned out to be kind of a disaster and so on. And you just felt such resentment. This is years later. And then you realize kind of in the midst of this, wait a minute, he apologized. I mean, just as you were thinking, he never apologized. Wait a minute. Yeah, he did apologize for that. And then you go to say this. This is one problem with harboring anger. The more you dwell on the insult, the deeper it burrows. You've dug a massive ditch like a channel for ships, and some little apology is a tiny piece of flimflam tossed atop all that water. It has no ballast, no weight. That's a marvelous observation, because I think people do that all the time. Hold on to anger, and it ends up creating this enormous power over you that you aren't even aware of. And it poisons the way you are looking at the world and looking at other people. And I am so appreciative of this observation that you make. I think it could be so helpful to so many people, even if you're not in the midst of a divorce.
Yeah, you know, we see this all the time, right? And I see this in my own life. Anger and other kinds of negative thinking. It's you keep telling yourself, you keep remembering it, right? And you rehearse it, and it becomes more and more real. And a lot of other stuff happened too, but that stuff gets effaced. I think it's partly because positive psychologists talk about negative emotions as being more potent and more gripping. And I think that's probably part of what's going on with anger. And there's an evolutionary reason for this, but these negative emotions like anger already stick with us, make a stronger impression on our psyche than a joyful moment or, you know, a beautiful sunset. So we have to work three times as hard to reinforce the positive and not give in to the negative. And if you're doing this, if you're, you know, he left me, he cheated, and if you're, you know, again and again, that it will take over your life. And I talk about, you know, there's a lot of different traditions for helping people get over anger. Like, people talk about this in religion. I quote this guy, Stephen Stosny, who worked with maximum security inmates to get over the anger that led them in jail. People talk about going to Alcoholics Anonymous, or the other one, Al-Anon. And somebody said, I realized that this anger would make me sick. And the woman I was talking about earlier, who had gone to France with her ex, you know, said this thing to her therapist, that people can get stuck in it for 20 years. And we absolutely see this in our real lives, and not just with divorce.
Mm. I liked the quote you have of Buddha saying, holding on to anger is like grasping a hot coal with the intent of throwing it at someone else. You are the one who gets burned. Which is sad but true. And this portion of the book ends with the idea that sometimes by stepping out and stepping away from your own anger, whether it's justified or not, and in a sense, you know, kind of being the bigger person, as it's often termed, that you can make a huge difference in the quality of this separation. You write, I've heard again and again how one person transformed a hostile divorce, perhaps by offering appreciation, encouragement, or unexpected praise. I mean, again, even outside the parameters of our specific topic today, that's great advice.
It's so amazing. You know, when you talk to people who are in a bad divorce and they list all of the, you know, the faults and the horrible behavior of their ex, it is so amazing to see how much power that person listing the faults may have. You know, that if that person says thank you, if that person says, I want to thank you for these wonderful children you've raised, or, you know, I want to thank you for you know, the hard work you've done or whatever it is, or I want to apologize for something I did in the past. It is amazing how much of an impact that can have on the vast majority of other partners, you know, of former partners. I mean, there are the people who are, you know, diagnosably crazy, but a lot of the anger you'll hear, you know, he's crazy, he's a narcissist, she's bipolar, you know, very often people may be acting in their worst possible, you know, maybe manifesting their worst possible selves, but actually they're not, you know, certifiably crazy. They're you know, divorce can be crazy making, and if you can be the bigger person, I've just seen this again and again, and many, you know, many lawyers, therapists, mediators I talked to said the same thing. Mm-hmm. When one person is able to step up and be the bigger person, it can absolutely transform a bad divorce into really a pretty decent one.
Mm-hmm. Wendy Paris is the author of Splittopia, Dispatches from Today's Good Divorce and How to Part Well, a book which is published by Atria Books. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, we're going to be playing part two of this conversation. Actually, when we first aired the Splittopia interview, we ran into some technical difficulties on the second day and had to postpone the broadcast of part two of this conversation. I'm glad that those technical difficulties could be resolved, and so at last you can finally hear the conclusion of my conversation with Wendy Paris on tomorrow's morning show. Right after that, you'll hear my conversation with Trevor Crowe Molyneux, who is a family therapist who has co-written a very, very interesting new book called Blending Families, Merging Households with Kids 8 to 18. Trevor Crowe Molyneux comes at this topic from a very personal point of view, having been someone who was both step-parented and also is herself a step-parent. And she has experienced this phenomenon of blending families in several different ways, and has written a very, very compelling book about the way in which that blending of families can be done most successfully, most happily for all concerned. So you'll hear that conversation tomorrow as well. Trevor Crowe Molyneux talking about her book, Blending Families, Merging Households with Kids 8 to 18. I hope that you can join us. You've already heard about the Thursday morning show. On Friday's morning show, I'm very excited to share with you a conversation which I recorded with a 90-year-old former Major League Baseball player by the name of Ransom Jackson. He was nicknamed during his playing career Handsome Ransom Jackson. And Mr. Jackson had the privilege of, among other things, playing both against and with the legendary Jackie Robinson and other great, great ballplayers of the 1950s. Mr. Jackson has written a very entertaining and interesting memoir about his days in Major League Baseball called Handsome Ransom Jackson, An Accidental Big Leaguer. And you will hear my conversation with Mr. Jackson on Friday's morning show. Support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the morning show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com.
coming up on 9 o'clock. We'll be joining NPR for the news at 9:01 and then Wisconsin Public Radio for their classical music programming right after that. Let's update the forecast for you from the National Weather Service. Going to be a real scorcher today, partly sunny and hot. Isolated showers and thunderstorms at a high heading for 89 degrees. Some perspective on that number. Normal high this time of year would be 75. The record high was 98. We hit that on June 15th, 1994. Tonight, sunset 8:33, partly cloudy.